The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
There's a love I hold dear, and it shines through each year, and it makes things seem different somehow. It's for better or worse, it's for people who thirst for a love that burns brighter right now. This is Carefree Highway Revisited, the show that celebrates the work of Gordon Lightfoot song by song, a proud member of the FM Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mike Messner, and along with me today is a fellow Lightfoot fan from North Carolina, Hank Battle. Hank, welcome to Carefree Highway Revisited.
Good to be here. Thanks so much, Mike.
So, Hank, how did you first get into Gordon Lightfoot and his music?
Gosh, it was 1977, and I went to a friend's house and was amazed because Gord's Gold was playing and filling the room. And I became a fan immediately, and I was playing a little guitar professionally at the time, and his style and pitch suited me very well. And I always liked the, in particular, the autobiographical nature of his work. So it made me a lifelong fan.
Well, I mean, if you listen to Gord's Gold, that was the way I started. And so I don't think there's a better way to get bitten by the Lightfoot bug than to listen to that particular record. What about concert experiences? Did you get a chance to see him in concert?
Yeah, I did. I actually went to see him at the Roanoke Civic Center. I think it was 1977, and I had gotten tickets and thought I was doing very well, had great seats, and got there, and it was quite cavernous. He had very few people there, which upset him tremendously. So as it turns out, I was able to move right on up to the front. And then I saw him in 2017 in Durham, right around the corner from here. But he was suffering from emphysema at the time, and he had to suck oxygen between sets, and his voice was pretty much gone then, and had a chance to go see him in Carolina Theater in Greensboro several years later. But I just didn't want to do it again. It was tough to hear him at the end of his career.
Yeah, I've heard, and I know that there is a CD that's come out not long ago about him live at Royal Albert Hall. And I don't have it, I haven't listened to it, and I'm almost scared to, because I want to remember him with that robust voice and the energy and all the things that we loved about Gordon when he was playing live. And this might be just a little too disillusioning. Did you ever get a chance to meet Lightfoot?
No, I actually had planned on doing so at that Roanoke concert, and he was so frustrated by the event that he didn't hang around. I never got a chance to meet him subsequently.
I can't say as I blame him, because if you're playing this huge arena and not many people show up, it's got to be disheartening. And I've heard other musicians say, you know, I had this 15,000 seat auditorium and 3,000 people showed up. I imagine he just wanted to put that behind him. His attitude is probably, this is a day best forgotten. Well, today we're talking about If Children Had Wings from the Endless Wire album, and that, of course, came out in 1978. This is an album that got good reviews, at least initially, but it's seen by many people as kind of a step down from Summertime Dream and Sundown. So I'm wondering, why did you want to talk about If Children Had Wings? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, I think having children who have grown, in a way, I certainly have empathized with him missing them and missing family life in general. And this one in particular got me interested in many of his other autobiographical works. But to me, it punctuates the fact that relationships are very difficult and that you could always have done them better. And I thought it was a pretty good song in the sense that he was talking very honestly about his past relationships and what he did to make them not work so well.
You know, it's the same kind of reason that I like the song. He's talking about life after divorce, but he's not doing it in a cliched way or a sneering way. And a lot of artists have gone through divorce, and a lot of them go through that and say things like, well, I'm so glad the bitch is gone, or, you know, the bastard didn't deserve me, or, you know, things like that, being very vindictive. Madonna did a lot after she divorced Sean Penn. James Taylor did a lot of that after he got divorced from Carly Simon, did a lot of reflecting on that. But it's rare for somebody to be that tender about divorce. And of course, the victim in divorce is always going to be the children, because they don't understand why mom doesn't live here anymore, why dad doesn't live here anymore. And it's done very sensitively, without being uncomfortable. It's not something where he's letting on these really deep secrets that make you squirm and make you want to turn the thing off. Do you have a special anecdote or an experience about what it means to you? You mentioned the fact that you have children that have grown and gone. So is this something that comes to mind when you think of them?
Absolutely. And, you know, the fact is, we all realize that we could have done better in relationships, no matter what the relationships were. And he is totally honest about that in this song. And it always behooves us to be honest about how things could have gone better, what we could have done, and then how we can turn around and make things better in the relationship we're in now. So it was very personal for me in that regard.
Thank you for sharing that, because you wouldn't have picked the song if you didn't like it. And, you know, it does have a meaning to you, clearly. Is this a song that you could listen to anytime, any place, doing anything? Or is there a particular setting or activity where this is the ideal place for Hank Battle to listen to if children had wings?
It was on my playlist, so I hear it often, but a pair of high-res earbuds or earphones, and especially when I'm away from my wife who's at home, it's always nice to put this one on, because it does make you wistful about being there and being away from your loved ones.
You know, I think for me, I have one child, and my son hasn't left home yet. He's 16. And so I think in about 2.5 years, this song is going to hit me right where I live. For me, though, I have missed people, and I've been on the end of a failing relationship and doing the same kind of thing that you were talking about. You know, how could I have done this better? And I think I would probably want to listen to this probably in the mid-morning when you're not going to work. Maybe it's a weekend and you've had your coffee or whatever. And you're awake enough so that you have some sensitivity to what is going on around you. And you're feeling nostalgic for someone or something. And then you realize it's 10 o'clock in the morning and I'm going to be up for another 12, 13 hours where I'm not going to see that person, or I'm not going to have that experience, or that thing is not going to be available to me. And so there's a real melancholy to it. And this is a sad song. But I think that to me would be the time and the experience and the setting where I would be.
When you do retire, you're going to look back on things and think about them quite wistfully. And I do think Lightfoot was able to do that throughout his life, to look back on things. You'll feel it even more so as you get older.
And Hank, you and I were talking about this right before we started our recording today, that you are a retired educator and I'm going to be one in a few years. So we have that experience in common. And so I'm going to take that piece of wisdom very much to heart, because I have a feeling it's going to come in very handy when the time comes. Well, let's talk about the genesis of how the song got written. According to Nicholas Jennings, Britta, who was Lightfoot's ex-wife at this time, had taken their two children, Fred and Ingrid, she'd taken them to the south of France because she wanted them to have a French education. She wanted them to have French immersion and really be a part of the culture of France. So if it was just French language, I think she probably just could have moved to Quebec, but she decided not to do that. And Lightfoot agreed to it, but he did miss them terribly. And at one time, he actually flew over to France to this tiny little village where they were staying, promptly got into a fight with Britta, and turned right around and went back home. And this song was, if not a direct result of that encounter, was certainly around the time of that encounter and had to do with the feelings of missing his children. Hank, is there any other information that you were able to glean about how the song got written?
Well, he certainly was feeling sadness and maybe a good bit of guilt about the dissolution of his family. And I'm sure he was wistful on and off during that span of time. I believe he and his wife divorced in like 73.
Yeah.
And I think in large part because of his infidelity, you know, he was famous for that and had a 3-year relationship with Kathy Smith. I've heard you talk about that in the early 70s. And
yeah.
In fact, I think he actually wrote Sundown about her in 74. So I think he was feeling tremendous guilt about the whole thing, and especially probably the effect on his children. And I remember reading he admitted himself to, as he put it, thinking about what a terrible person he was at the time of his marriage. And it always reminds me of the line, "Heroes often fail." And if you can read my mind, I think he realized that he failed. And so I think this was clearly about that period of time in his life and how guilty he was about the pain that he had caused in his marriage and with his children.
You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two.
Hey, do you like classic albums? Technically, like, the, you know, the 20th century albums, such as, like, Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones. I've only had Beatle episodes so far, however, I'll be doing more. But, welcome to my show, or rather, hey, welcome to... check out my show! all those years ago, a classic album podcast with The Dipping Sauce... as you can see, the George Harrison reference. I review classic albums, not of those, the likes of Beethoven, the likes of the Beatles and Rolling Stones, and like I mentioned earlier, or what have you. So yeah, check it out. It's every Monday. I do albums, conspiracies, songs, all that jazz. So just check it out. All those years ago, a classic album podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
One minute, you're a teacher preparing for the new school year. The next, you're transported to a fantastical realm shrouded in forgotten magic. The creatures around you think you're a long-vanished mage. You have no technology. You have no memory of how you got here, and no idea how to get home. All you have is misplaced magic. Haladar, the Last Surveyor, is the new fantasy novel by acclaimed author Rob Perrier. Available now on Amazon.com and RobPerrier.com. I couldn't agree with you more. And it was at a time when he was emotionally vulnerable. He was very tired, I think emotionally exhausted and physically exhausted. He'd just come off of this whirlwind from 74 to 77, where he was touring and recording and performing, and it just didn't stop. And a lot of critics have said about Endless Wire that it should have been called Endless Touring Makes the Quality of Your Music Go Down. But that being said, I mean, it's still him being very, very genuine about this time in his life, and he was feeling a lot of sadness and a lot of regret too. So let's look at the lyrics a little bit. There's a love I hold dear, and it shines through each year, and it makes things seem different somehow. It's for better or worse. It's for people who thirst for a love that burns brighter right now. And it's the idea that the kind of love that he and Britta felt, and maybe that he and his children are feeling, is... it's a love that quenches the thirst of people who really need love, really need acceptance, really are beaten down, really have been through something negative, and they need it right away. A love that burns brighter right now. This is not someday my prince will come. This is an urgent need for affirmation. At least that's the angle I get. Anything you can add to that?
It was pretty telling that he wrote for better or for worse, both obviously the marriage vows, right? So while I do think it was more about the children than it was his wife or his ex-wife, it's clear that he feels guilt and sadness about not having that particular relationship. And I appreciated that turn of the phrase.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. But in a way, I guess he's also saying that I will love you, my children, for better or for worse, even though we don't take that vow when we become parents. But in many cases, and certainly in the case with Gordon and Britta, they had promised each other for better or worse, and that was extending to kids. And obviously, things have evolved in terms of family relations, but I think a lot of marriages do end up with kids, and I think there is a certain commitment that comes with that. At least we hope there is going to be, for the sake of the kids. And it shines on and on till all sadness is gone. And if children had wings, I would sing them this song. Now, you talk about a turn of phrase. It's an interesting conditionality here because children don't have wings. But I'm wondering, why can't he sing them this song now? He's saying, if they have wings, I would sing them this song. But yet here he is doing it. So I'm wondering why he chose that or what he's trying to say here, because he's clearly communicating. He's not saying, gee, I can't say anything to you.
Yeah, they're far away. And like you said, he did go there. But I think the idea of having them come back and at the very least just to hear him sing that song and then fly right back. So they're not going to be there for long, but temporarily, at least they can hear the song. And who knows, he may sing them The Pony Man or something else that relates directly to his children, just for the song, because after all, he has other things that he wants to do and other people he wants to be with. And so I'm not sure how much time he really wants to spend.
Yeah, we don't have a real angle on how much he saw his kids during their formative years. I mean, now, of course, they're thousands of miles away, and he was probably, this sounds terrible, but he was too busy to be a good father. If he wasn't busy writing, touring, recording, performing, he was busy chasing women because that was something that he did in his younger years. That was a choice he made, and he has to or had to live with it, with the consequences of that. And this maybe is one of them. With a smile on my face and a tear in my eye, everything will be fine by and by. And I get the picture of he's having this argument with Britta, and the kids, if they're not in the room, maybe they're upstairs or they're in the next room or they can hear the shouting going on. So they're present to it in some way and they're hurting. And he wants to be there to comfort them, saying, yes, we had this terrible fight, this terrible conflict. We're not living with each other anymore. Everything will be okay in the long run. And you hope it will, but given the fact that he's a professional musician and he's trying to keep up this incredible momentum that he had in the mid-70s, didn't seem like it was very likely.
Yeah, you would know better than I, but I do get the sense that maybe he was a better husband and a better father in his subsequent relationships than he was early on because of his touring, but also, you know, because he learned from it a little bit. And I do think that maybe that was part of his guilt as well.
Oh, yeah. He certainly had a more, no pun intended, sober way of looking at his relationships and his marriage and his role as a father later on in life. And I'm not saying that with an intentional reference towards his alcoholism, but he certainly had a clearer vision of what his responsibilities were, what he should have done, what he failed to do when he got older. And that is part of the human condition. It's part of being a human being and part of living.
He was, as you know, well known for being such a nice guy.
Yeah.
And for being good to people and never meeting anyone that he wasn't good with, and probably had something to do with that as well. I think he probably learned to appreciate people more because of his past relationships.
He's learned to value them. And I think it's maybe not that he didn't value them before, but he's certainly not using them for his own ends as much if he ever was to begin with. I think it might be one way of phrasing what you're saying here. Yeah, always a nice guy, but as we also know, and as he's also alluded to, there was also a hidden agenda at times. So again, that's part of being a rock star. And that's in essence what Gordon was. There were things that were said, there were things that were done, and a wife cannot stand too much pain. This is as vulnerable as you can get with Gordon Lightfoot's lyrics. He pushed this woman, he pushed Britta away with everything that he said and everything that he did, not just in the past, but maybe his kids were hoping, okay, daddy's going to come and maybe he and mommy will be able to patch things up. Maybe they had this hope that only a child can have in their naivete about it, that there's going to be a reconciliation. And what I thought was best couldn't please her much less. He did what he thought was best, not at all what she wanted and what she needed. So there's even this kind of an unintentional confession that he was only taking one perspective, not hers.
Yeah, and you know what else, especially in his case, but often the father feels like what's best for the family is for him to go out and earn money. You hear Gordon Lightfoot talk about that in his later years, always saying he has to pay the bills for everyone. And he's not talking about the hangers-on. He's talking about his family and all of his children. And I mean, he ended up with a fair amount of money. I think his net worth was like $40 million when he died. But he always felt like he needed to pay his bills, take care of his family, take care of his kids, whether he was with them or not. And that was his way of doing what he thought was best at the time.
And you're right about the whole idea of father figures. And I think this is something that we share as men, that we do feel like we need to be providers. And we don't necessarily feel comfortable about somebody else being the provider for the people that we've made this commitment to. And Gordon, I think, must have gotten that from his own father, although they had a complicated relationship. I think that's honorable for him to want to provide for the women in his life, for the children in his life, and for his band too. I mean, they always flew first class together. You know, they were always very well taken care of. The other side of that is that your money won't buy time, to quote James Taylor, that you only have so many hours in every day and in every lifetime. And there's an opportunity cost. The time you're spending on earning money means that it's time you're not spending with your family. And I think he probably learned that lesson very painfully.
Yeah, sometimes when you're traveling and you run into people and you both recognize that you're being paid to travel, you're being paid to be away from your family. And he certainly was paid to be away from his family.
Yeah, there must be a better way of saying that, Hank, but it's true. But my love still goes on, that don't change. And it's certainly love for his kids and maybe love for Britta as well, because we know that he wrote Beautiful for her. That ended up on Gord's Gold. And it's one that I think he played quite a bit in concert. I don't have my notes for that song in front of me, but there was a lot of feeling there. I think even with the anger and the rancor and the woundedness, I think there was still some positive emotion there.
He also didn't seem to hold grudges. At least I wasn't aware of him doing that. And to hear him talk from time to time, he seemed to think the best of a lot of people.
Yeah, I don't think there were too many people that he went to his grave shaking his fist at. And then he repeats the chorus two more times, which is not the accustomed style for Lightfoot. He usually says his piece and gets out. My guess is that whomever was producing this said, you know, Gordon, as of right now, this is not even 2 minutes long. We need to lengthen it out, because he'd pretty much said what he needed to say. He didn't need to add a third verse, and he didn't. He just reiterated that And I understand why they did it from a production point of view, but he said so much in just this fairly short stretch of lyrics.
I've often wondered if he ran out of things to say. He had said the few things that he felt, and there just wasn't anything else that he could think of to say.
And sometimes there is nothing else to say. I think songwriting is maybe the most challenging kind of writing you can do, because you're trying to express something in a fairly limited way. So you have to do the poetry aspect of it, but you can't have it longer than so long or people are going to cack out. With all due respect to Bob Dylan and Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands or Joey or things like that, I don't want to listen to a song that long. And Lightfoot was as good as anyone ever in saying things very compactly and very beautifully and getting out. And so, yeah, I think in this case, there really was nothing left to say. You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two.
Hey, I just wanted to take a second to tell you about my latest podcast discovery. Fire Breathing Kittens is an actual play one-shot podcast that plays various tabletop role-playing games with a season-long plot. Because there's a beginning and an end to each week's story, you can start at any episode. Yeah, you won't miss a thing. Every week has a different combination of four from the same rotating cast of people. Join Fire Breathing Kittens as they solve detective mysteries, attempt comedic banter, and enjoy friendship. That's Fire Breathing Kittens podcast. Check it out.
Have you checked out the Dylan Taunts? It's a podcast full of smart conversations with interesting Dylan scholars, academics, and fans. Find it at fmpods.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, the song was on the Endless Wire album in 1978. It was his 12th original album, had much of the usual lot. Gordon, Terry, Rick, Pee-wee, Red, Tom Sesniak, I hope I pronounced that right, who also did bass on a few of the tracks. Barry Keane played drums, and then there was a gentleman named Doug Riley who did the orchestration and also played piano. I didn't see anything for keyboards, but I think we could probably extrapolate and say that was an electric piano there. It was the 9th song on the record, so it was coming towards the end of this thing. It was not released as a single, and that was probably because the original length was just too short for a single. The album went to number 2 in Canada, number 22 in the US, and 56 in Australia. Apparently did not chart in the UK. So it's a little bit of a drop-off for Gordon in terms of popularity, because Sundown had been number 1 and Summertime Dream had been in the top 10. And so this one's falling a little bit. And maybe people were getting a little bit tired of Gordon at that point because he'd had 2 amazing albums and 3 or 4 amazing years. And people were beginning to move on just a little bit from that. Now, I'm going to talk about the frequency of the song in just a second or two, but I'm wondering if you have a favorite musical aspect of the recording that is on Endless Wire.
Yeah, probably for me, it was the orchestration. I found it very appealing. I always liked the bass lines in the song. I'm not a pianist, so I didn't love the piano part. I wish maybe it could have had a little more prominent acoustic guitar, but I just think the orchestration on that song in particular was one of his best.
You know, we agree on that because I did not like the vibes, because I think it could have been done just as well with an actual acoustic piano, you know, to get a grand piano to do that keyboard part. And it would have been a different feel, but I think it would have aged better, because when I listen to it now, it's a beautiful song. But when I think of the vibes, I'm thinking this is an instrument that people really don't play very much anymore. And so it dates the song a little bit just for me. It comes across as being a little bit too 70s.
And do you think he was like trying to move along with the time? He had been such a good folk singer, singer-songwriter, and all of a sudden, you know, those times are passing him by a little bit. He's trying to get maybe a little more relevant at the time. I'm not sure.
Well, he did try to make the album a little bit more rockin', and it didn't always work. And that is, again, why this album is seen by many as being a step down, because they're not used to him doing this kind of music, this kind of arrangement, these kinds of instruments. And I can tell you, I mean, the very first time I heard the song Endless Wire, I thought, what is this? You know, I'm not used to him having this searing electric guitar riff straight out of the gate. But I think for me, my favorite musical aspect is his vocal. And he has never done a vocal I haven't liked. Every song he's ever recorded, I've absolutely loved his voice. But in this one, because he's in the middle of all of these emotions, the song is still very fresh to him when he's recording it. And I can hear his voice crack once or twice during the recording. So he's getting emotionally caught up in what he's singing in a way that maybe he didn't in some other songs, because it was truly so autobiographical, like you said, Hank. So I would say that his voice was probably my favorite part of the whole thing. I cannot find any official covers of the song. Now, they did shut down Lightfoot.ca, so I don't have the same kind of online resources as I once did. But do you know of anyone who has covered this song besides people just turning on a camera and recording something to YouTube?
No, I don't think it was ever covered, and it might be a tough one to cover because it probably could have been viewed as too depressing and certainly pertaining to his life specifically, but I don't think anyone ever covered the song.
You mentioned the idea that there's not many people who could do it justice, because it is a sad song, but it's sad in a heartfelt way as opposed to sad like The Cure, where you deliberately want to get depressed, or you're already depressed and you're going to listen to this really heavy, depressing music. If I had to choose someone that I wanted to cover it, I would like to hear Billy Joel do it, because he certainly knows what it's like to go through divorce. And he has kids. He has at least one child with Christie Brinkley, and may have other children too. I don't know. And then maybe George Strait, because I like George's voice, and I don't know what his personal life has been like, but I know that he could do justice to this because there is a certain country feel to it. Is there anybody that you would like to hear do it, or is this one that needs to stand alone?
I'd love to hear Darius Rucker do it, and I'd love to hear Blake Shelton do it. You and I both like James Taylor very much. I think he'd do it very well, too. Any of those three would be great. I don't think it'll ever be done, but it would be nice to hear them.
Yeah, James is not well known for writing or singing other people's music.
That's right.
And he's done a smattering of them, but they have become so much part of his own lexicon that it's hard for me to remember that Up on the Roof was done by the Drifters. I always identify it that way. Or that Carole King wrote You've Got a Friend. You think of James doing it. With all due respect to the Carole King fans who may be listening, it's just something that's so identified with him. Hank, as we're wrapping up here, are there any other thoughts you have on If Children Had Wings?
I'll just say that for a song that is sad, it's still, in my view, one of his best songs. And he sings it so well, as you mentioned. I see positive things about it just because I do think he is giving real serious thought to things that he could have done better and would subsequently do better. So even though it's sad, there's a juxtaposition in it that makes it in some ways positive as well.
Hank Battle, thank you so much for being here this afternoon. It's great to talk to fellow Lightfoot fans and fellow educators and fellow musicians. And it's rare that I get to talk to all three at once, and hope to have you on the show again next season.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Mike.
And thanks for listening, everybody. If you like this well enough to listen to the whole thing, tell somebody about it. Carefree Highway Revisited is on Apple, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your listening matter. I'd like to make a special request for you to visit my Patreon page. I love this show so much, and I want to keep it going. and you're in a position to help. Please head over to www.patreon.com/carefreehighwayrevisited. A dollar or two a month is all I ask. You can reach me, Mike Messner, at teachermike72@gmail.com. Well, this is the last show of season 3 of Carefree Highway Revisited, but please don't worry. The school year is coming to an end and I am going on vacation. So I will be resuming in September of 2024 with season 4. We got a lot more music to examine. Until then, for Hank Battle, this is Mike Messner reminding you, run for the roses, but don't forget to stop and smell them. See you in the fall.